Not too long ago, the Columbia Journalism Review published a special issue on the state of local news. And a map of the United States highlighted the prevalence of news deserts, that is, counties with no sources of local daily news. Perhaps not surprisingly, the map showed pretty big swaths of rural Kansas and Missouri swallowed up by that local news void. But is it really that simple? People who live in those communities have responded by saying that there are daily papers flying under the national radar. And lots of communities without daily news have papers that publish weekly, if not several times a week. So does that constitute a true news desert, or is news circulating just fine in rural America? We want to know if there's a robust local news source in your community, and if not, how do you stay informed? Where does accountability come from? Call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to start by talking with Roy Wenzel, who worked until recently for the Wichita Eagle. Hi, Roy.
Hello.
So Wichita is a big city, but you grew up in a rural community. Is that right?
I grew up in Washington County, which is on the border with Nebraska, more or less north, a little northwest of Manhattan.
So talk to me about the role of local news in the community where you grew up.
Well, we were very lucky there. Washington County is very rural. I think there's only something like 4,000 or 5,000 people left. There were a few more when I grew up there 40 years ago. We were very lucky because we had a newspaper run by the Buchanan family, Christine and Tom. They were wonderful. They were my mentors. They're part of the reason I got into journalism in the first place. But they did a weekly, published a weekly. It was very well done, well written, thoroughly reported, and it added a lot to the community.
Can you explain that a little more? What did it add to the community, and what kinds of stories were being covered?
Well, people in small towns don't have a lot left to give them identity, but they still have their schools. So my first paid job was writing football stories when I was a senior at Washington High School. I'd go to the game, I'd write up something the next day and turn it in, and the Buchanans paid me. And people, you know, really got fired up at football games. The same thing with basketball. It's a part of the community identity. So that was one way in which, you know, everybody wanted to read the football stories and the basketball stories. But they did a lot more. They wrote editorials, they wrote columns that were funny and well done. They commented about things locally, and they covered the news. So they covered the government, so people kind of knew what was going on with the county commission, with the city. If there was an accident, they would explain what caused the accident. So, and then there were all the things that most people care about more than news, which is advertisements. So they did a good job of relating well to the local business community, and so people knew when the sales were. They knew where they wanted to shop on a given day. They knew what the specials were, and so it just added so much to the community. It's a shame that so many rural areas of the country have lost all of that.
You know, when you talk about political coverage, I mean, I guess within a state, for example, like the governor is the same for the entire state, but I wonder if it is important to have people in a particular part of a state talking about how the news affects that community in particular. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And you just brought up an area that would be very tricky for any small weekly or daily newspaper to handle, because people get pretty easily upset one way or the other. So if there's this, and there's also this thread, which I think is very unfair, that all media is whatever, liberal or slanted, or, I mean, that's just not true. And the way many rural area journalists have handled that is they long ago stopped writing, you know, political commentary, for example. They would still print letters to the editor, but they would just try to steer clear of it so that the local people wouldn't give them the side eye. But they also, many
Can I just jump
newspapers.
In and ask you, when you
Yeah.
say that a lot of newspapers in rural communities cut that out a long time ago, how long ago are you talking about?
Decades. Decades. I mean, you just don't want to go there where you needlessly stir people up. So, you know, it's okay to cover the county fair. It's okay to cover the latest tax debate in the county commission, but you don't want to wade in and start, you know, voicing your opinion all that much about what the state house might be doing or what the national government might be doing. The thought is that, you know, there are plenty of other ways for people to get their national and state news that way. So you don't want to needlessly draw a fire when your job is to keep a business afloat, a business that doesn't, in a rural area, doesn't necessarily make that much money. So you do a good job with the ads, you do a good job with local news and feature stories and sports, but you kind of steer clear from that.
What does it mean to do a good job with local news?
Well, some in small areas, sometimes that takes just odd forms. Like, I don't know if they still do this, but the Washington County News still exists. It's still a very good newspaper. And one thing that it did years ago, 50 years ago, there were hardly any wild deer in Kansas. And now the state is just overrun with them. There are no natural predators. And so I noticed something about 30 years ago, that in the Washington County News, every week they would do the usual thing they'd done for decades, which was they would print the police calls. They would scoop up all the police calls made by the county sheriff's office for that week, and they would print them. Just, you know, very fact things. This happened, that happened, there was an accident. Well,
why?
Nine out of 10 of those sheriff's office calls were about deer accidents with cars. So just from reading that alone, you realize, especially if you grew up there and at a time when there were hardly any deer in rural Kansas, all of a sudden there are all these accidents, like 10 or 12 accidents, and almost all of them are deer accidents, which that's a lot of money to repair your fenders and your windshields. It's dangerous. So just from covering little things like that in a rural area, you kind of know what's going on. And
so the data tells a story.
Yeah, the data tells a story.
Well, I mean, I'm curious, when we talk about the absence of daily news outlets in some areas, does it matter? I mean, you're talking about a weekly publication. Do you think that that is in some way a void, or do you think weekly is enough in some places?
When I grew up, we all had, in Washington County, almost a lot of people had dailies, and they would subscribe also to the weekly paper. And that was a good thing. So, for example, in Washington County, it was the Topeka Capital Journal. So, and that was loaded with State House news because that's where the Capitol is. So we subscribed to that. We subscribed to the weekly. And so you had a pretty good sense of what was going on in the community and in the state. And I think as everything has shrunk up, as Washington County depopulated, like so many other Kansas counties, there wasn't, you know, people started spending money on other things, subscriptions tailed off. And so now people don't, you know, it's probably a rare thing up there to find people subscribing to a daily newspaper.
Would you say that the readership, though, for all of that, I mean, you're talking about a rural readership and the daily news coming out of Topeka, the capital. Is it important for sometimes that news to come from your own community, to come from a rural perspective?
Well, ideally, yes. I would hope that people would want to be informed. I would hope that they would want to know what's going on in the state house. I would hope that they would want to know that even if there's not necessarily a local burning issue, like, for example, school consolidation, anytime that ever comes up, that becomes very divisive and people get animated. But I would hope that people would want to know what's going on and some of the reasons why something like school consolidation might be going on.
Well, Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about how news travels in the rural community you come from or you live in today. At 816-235-2888, Sarah Kessinger is with us now from the Marysville Advocate, which publishes weekly. Hi, Sarah. Sarah, are you with us? Okay, Sarah might not be with us right now, so I'll just stick with you, Roy. How does that sound?
That sounds fine.
Okay.
I hope you get to talk to her because they do a great job in Marysville.
I'm interested in knowing whether rural readers of news or consumers of news in whatever format have a need for a kind of information that wouldn't come from a city-based publication.
Oh, I think so. I think people want to know what's going on. A lot of people nowadays, though, have smartphones like everybody else. Computers, so they get their news off of Facebook or off of whatever publications they've subscribed to on their smartphone. I would hope that people and a lot of people in rural areas also do something that maybe city people don't do quite as much, which is farmers, for example, on a tractor will be rolling around disking a field or cutting hay, and they'll have a tractor with a cab, and it's got not only air conditioning, thank God, which I didn't have on our farm, but it'll have a radio, so they can tune in and listen to news programs or talk radio.
Well, I guess what I'm curious about is there a kind of news that just wouldn't even be covered from a city-based vantage point, like that an urban journalist wouldn't even think that someone might care about, but that is significant in a more rural community?
Well, in a rural community like the one I grew up in, and this would be most of Kansas, agriculture is done by most of the people. Even if you're not a farmer, if you live in a small town, you're affected by all of this. There are plenty of things. And there are also niche publications, you know, small weekly newspapers, small magazines that cater to agriculture. So if, for example, the economy has diminished recently, a small publication like the Washington County News might delve into how, for example, there's not quite as much tax revenue for the county this year, and it's because the sales of agricultural equipment have tailed off because of the economy. Road construction, very local, and in a county with only 4,000 or 5,000 people, you kind of want to know in advance that Highway 36 might be shut down for a while, for a couple of months while they repair a bridge, because you drive your grain trucks over that bridge to get to town. That kind of thing. So yeah, there are plenty of things in these rural areas where micro coverage, as some people might call it, is appreciated when it's done right.
Well, we've got Sarah Kessinger with us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
You are with us from the Marysville Advocate, which publishes weekly. Tell us first of all where Marysville is and about the town and about the community you serve.
Okay, Marysville is in Marshall County, which is just next door to Washington County. We're just to the east of there, and we're a county of about 10,000 people. The city of Marysville has about 3,000, and we're a largely agricultural and manufacturing community, and we have, Landall Corporation, which is our largest employer here. And they employ close to 800 people right now.
What do they do?
They manufacture agricultural equipment and forklifts and large trailers for large industry. So they're rather diversified, and it's been a good way to hold our population here, thanks to one very large manufacturer here. We also have smaller manufacturing of envelopes. Tension envelope, and we have Valley Veterinary Supply, which sends veterinary supplies worldwide, And so we have a nice mix of industry and then some local retail as well.
So how much would you say there is to cover? I mean, you publish weekly. Are there blind spots? Things that you can't get to in your weekly schedule?
I would say covering things weekly helps. If something happens on our press day when we're all busy putting packaging and distributing the newspaper on those day, on that day, Wednesday, it can be something of a strain to get somebody out to cover something. We do it, but that's the only thing that obstacle really to covering local news is we're limited by the size of our staff. But I would say we try to do the best we can with a newsroom of about 5 people.
5 people. And it sounds like you wear a lot of hats if you're packaging up the paper physically yourself.
Yes, we do. We get our hands dirty, and but we also have to write, edit, report, do the photography. Everybody learns everything here, and it's a good place to get to cut your teeth and learn, just what goes into putting out a newspaper because we do it all. But I enjoy it. I enjoy the variety.
You know,
That's a
you're
good
talking
thing.
about industry and the mix of different industries plus agricultural areas, and I'm curious about accountability. I mean, is that a big part of your role? Have there been situations where you've given voice to people who are dealing with a situation that no one would know about otherwise?
Well, I think so. For example, covering our county commissioners, nobody really attends those meetings because they're in the morning, in the middle of the morning on Monday morning. And so people can't get away from work to go over and listen in lots of times on what they're doing. And a lot of their work is focused on county roads and bridges, which is a big, deal for farmers around here. And farmers want to know when a bridge is out because they need to get their crops through to market. And in this day and age, that's millions of dollars often that, is being moved. And so it's important to cover, what they're working on, what they're approving in their budget, and then, also other functions within county government. We have kind of a debate going on right now about whether county government has a role in funding economic development, which can be quite a strain for a small county. But
Can you explain that
we need
debate?
to. Sure. We have a local coalition of local governments and business and industry that is working together to try to attract new business and retain the business we have and grow it. And they would like the county to contribute some to that, and they have in small part in recent years, but they'd like the county to step up their contribution to that. At the same time, the county is under a new local sales, or sorry, local property tax cap from the imposed by the state legislature, and so they're struggling to grow their budget at all. If they do, they have to take it to a public vote according to this new law, and commissioners don't want to do that. They want to try to keep the budget level, and so
So,
there's kind of this challenge.
what's the role of the newspaper in that debate?
Well, we cover it, try to cover, all sides of that debate, and to, I guess, show what other counties are doing, other rural counties, talk to other economic development programs in other counties, and then regional economic development organizations, which help this county. For example, there's a regional economic development group in North Central Kansas that the county is a member of, and they help the county land grants to fix infrastructure, to pay for new sewage systems or new sidewalks or all kinds of things. So these grants are huge to the counties, but our county commissioners are also questioning whether we should be a member of that organization, which is in my editorial viewpoint, crazy. I think we need to be a part of these regional groups that are working together to draw in federal grant money. And so we not only have to cover the issue, then I will editorialize on it on our editorial page and try to promote a viewpoint of, I hope, progress for our county.
We'll come right back to this. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And when we return, we'll hear from you, too, about how news travels in your rural community. 816-235-2888. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we're asking whether there are parts of rural Kansas and Missouri that are news deserts. Sarah Kessinger is with us from the Marysville Advocate north of Topeka. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And Roy Wenzel is a former reporter for the Wichita Eagle. He grew up in a sparsely populated county that still has its own newspaper. Hi, Roy.
Hello, and hello, Sarah.
Hi, Roy.
So, you know, Sarah, according to the Columbia Journalism Review, the county where you work as a journalist counts as a news desert. You're not daily. Do you feel like you are part of a news desert?
I don't feel we are locally with the as far as coverage of local news, but I do feel like we have seen some real changes here in terms of regional and state news, as far as the printed publications that are thrown here, there you can no longer get a Kansas City Star here in Marysville during the week, only on weekends, and they don't throw it. You have to buy it on the newsstand. And then the Omaha World Herald used to circulate into here when I first moved back here 10 years ago, and they're also have pulled out. And so the circulation for print publications is still pretty good in this county. And I think a lot of people missed those papers when they left. And I feel like those papers shot themselves in the foot in, you know, just reducing their news coverage of this region and informing people. And I do think we see it reflected somewhat in our elections and in just general, I think people, you know, just aren't as aware of what's going on in the region as they used to be. And that's a problem, I think.
How do you see it reflected in the elections? I mean, can you be a little more specific?
Well, I think people tend to vote just down ticket on, we're a heavily Republican county now, and we used to be kind of, you know, somewhat Republican and, you know, a larger swath of moderate Democrat here. And the county, I just think that people don't get as much coverage of political issues as they used to in order to make better choices. And
so they're voting by party rather than information on the candidates.
Yeah, just voting straight down the ticket and rather than stopping and looking at the candidate. And the candidates don't come up here as much either anymore, which is reflective of probably population loss. We haven't lost as much population in this county, but we're lumped in with all the counties that have. And so, you know, it's viewed as, oh, there's not that many people there anymore, so we don't need to campaign there. And that's unfortunate.
But then the less frequent visits creates a particular need, news-wise.
Right. We don't get to cover them when they, you know, if they don't come out as much. And people do, you know, read the internet, read their, you know, website, whatever website, and then read newspapers online somewhat. But I think that when the print publications pulled out of here, among those, you know, larger regional metro papers, then we saw, I think it was, there were changes here.
Well, Michael has called 816-235-2888 from Shawnee, Kansas. Michael, what's your question?
My question is, when I was in school, I'd get from time to time a newspaper, someone bringing in the Chillicothe newspaper. I'm hoping somebody will call in and talk about that. But in that newspaper, there was a rural community called Lily Grove. And the way that they sent things in, they would look at what had happened that week in their town, their little small town, and they would send in information. Well, the interesting part about it is that they would start off the first week, and they might say somebody had a birthday party, and they had so much fun, and somebody came to the birthday party. But then the next 2 or 3 weeks after that, it may be that that same person possibly passed away. So it got to be interesting. Look into it to see what happened. But they would have to send it in, I think, on a weekly basis or so, and then for them to get it into the paper the next week, it would come up altogether different. You know, so it got to be kind of interesting the way that they did it. But the town was called Lily Grove, and some of the people there, I still remember the names as well, you know, I mean, especially one person that I remember.
Yeah, Michael, that's an interesting, I mean, Sarah, Michael has just shared with us the way that several smaller communities within a region kind of managed to pool resources, news staff-wise, kind of, and that it had its side effects, but that it was at least an attempt. Does that kind of thing still happen where do you cover particular communities within the region surrounding Marysville?
We do, and we do rely on people in those communities to send us their news in the outlying parts of the county. But it's important. People, you know, love to read it, and we do have subscribers simply because of that. They want to know what's going on in their little corner of Marshall County, or if they formerly lived there. There's a lot of, you know, loyalty to those communities and from people who have moved away. And so we have subscribers who they want to know what's happening. And yeah, the births, deaths, all of that really important information.
Roy had asked, he had mentioned earlier that the editorial had kind of long since faded from rural papers. And I'm wondering if that's been true for you.
No, we've kept ours going here, and I think that's, you know, the heart, one of the hearts of community journalism, and I know this wouldn't be the same newspaper without it, and our community, I think, expects it, and they don't, definitely, I'm probably more of a moderate voice in a somewhat conservative area, and so, you know, I get letters to the editor, and I appreciate those. I like to run them. And I think that there's a lot of interest in local debate and local issues.
Well,
and,
we're going to have to cut it off there, but people keep tweeting us. We're at KCURCST. Talk to us about how you feel about rural journalism. Sarah Kessinger of the Marysville Advocate, thank you.
Thank you.
And Roy Wenzel, former reporter for the Wichita Eagle, it's been great hearing from you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll chat with ballet icon Misty Copeland, whose story began here in Kansas City. She's in town, but her event has sold out, so don't miss this opportunity to hear from her after the break. Even if you aren't a ballet aficionado, there's a good chance you've heard of Misty Copeland, a documentary about her journey as the first African-American principal dancer in the American Ballet Theater came out in 2015. It drew a lot of attention to race in the world of dance. It also turned Misty Copeland into a household name. What you might not know is that she was born in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and it's an honor to be speaking with Misty Copeland as she returns to her hometown. Hi, Misty.
Hi.
So you are here with a new book, and we're going to get to that, but I want to start with Kansas City because we're here.
Okay.
Your memoir, A Life in Motion, begins with a ride away from Kansas City on a Greyhound bus.
Right, yes. You know, it's funny. I don't have a lot of memory of Kansas City, but I have family still there, and I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, but moved to California, to Southern California, when I was 2 years old. But I feel like I have these kind of not my own memories, but memories of my mother's, just from hearing so many stories about her growing up and being, you know, a Kansas City Chiefs cheerleader. And she was, you know, we were diehard Kansas City Chiefs fans, even as children, not knowing what we were really rooting for.
It seems like it also has kind of like leaving here was the beginning of, a certain kind of childhood experience that
right
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I was one of four children when my mother left Kansas City and moved to California. And that kind of was the beginning of what became really familiar to me, which was moving a lot and not really having stability in terms of where I was and schools and you know, even a place to live. So leaving Kansas, you know, really just kind of began this rocky childhood for me and my siblings. We eventually became six kids, and it wasn't until I was 13 years old that I stumbled into a ballet class, which forever changed my life. But, you know, all of it kind of just led me to this path. You know, if I weren't in a situation of not having a stable home and my mother working many jobs, I wouldn't have been attending the Boys and Girls Club of San Pedro, California, you know, the community center where I found ballet. So, you know, I'm so thankful and grateful for my path, as hard as it was for all of us kids and my mother as well, raising us pretty much on our own. I wouldn't be who I am and where I am if I didn't have that path and gotten on that Greyhound bus leaving Kansas City at 2 years old.
Yeah, I mean, 2 years old is so young. And then you talk about finding dance at 13. Do you think that was the next, like, home you had? Or is that an exaggeration?
Not an exaggeration at all. I mean, it absolutely became that to me, and probably, you know, the first conscious home that I can remember, you know, because I was so young when I left Kansas. But the stage and the ballet studio became the only real constant in my life, and the one place that it, you know, there wasn't chaos. There weren't, you know, sports games on the TV and all of us screaming in one room, all of us kids, you know, just existing in, you know, small spaces and not always having our own space and own room. Ballet was just the sanctuary and became just this really stable atmosphere for me and the first in my life.
Other than like that psychological aspect of it, what do you think it was that made you fall in love with ballet? Can you put your finger on it?
It was a combination of things. I think when I first, you know, being introduced to movement through my mother from a young age and having music constantly, you know, on around the house, I felt a very organic connection to creating with my body. So that was kind of the first step to leading me towards dance. But it was probably having that escape and that place that was so far from what I knew as familiar in my life. The studio was the first place that was just like this serene, calm place where I could be free and have a voice and create and not feel judged or have to speak in order to communicate. And it's really interesting that I didn't feel judged, because when you're in a ballet class, I mean, you're staring in a mirror, judging yourself, and you're getting so much criticism from, you know, the teacher, the ballet mistress. So it's very interesting that I had that response to it.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me too. I mean, they say that you were a true prodigy. Did you feel that?
I knew that it was easier for me. It wasn't, but the thing is, I don't think I'd ever experienced being on a team, being a part of, you know, sport in any way, and school was all I knew, which was a struggle for me. I never felt comfortable in school. I never felt confident. I always felt like I was just trying to fit in and not be seen. But in ballet, I was okay with working really hard, and I loved the journey of learning something new every single day. There was just something that felt so natural for me. And like my body just kind of fit into this world and I just adapted really easily.
You say many times as a refrain in your memoir, this is for the little brown girls. Can you explain what that means to you?
Yeah, you know, it's something that's kind of become more conscious for me the older that I got in my professional career. You know, coming from a biracial family, you know, being African American was not always something that I was, you know, thinking about. My mother made it very clear that, you know, I'm of Italian, German, and African American descent, but most likely the way that we look and living in America, we're going to be seen as Black African Americans. So that was something that I was very aware of, but it wasn't until I was in the ballet studio and a professional that I really realized the lack of diversity in the classical ballet world. And growing up, you know, having the privilege of growing up in a really diverse community in Southern California, that wasn't something that ever crossed my mind. You know, there was just every hue and every nationality, you know, where I grew up. And so it wasn't until I was, you know, a professional and I realized, you know, why am I doing this? Do I really belong here? Will I ever truly succeed beyond, you know, being in American Ballet Theater and being in the Court of Ballet is a huge accomplishment.
But yeah, that's like basically the center of gravity for the ballet world.
It absolutely is. And to be, you know, the only African-American woman in the company for 10 years, I started to kind of question my purpose and whether or not I was really being accepted by, you know, audience members, because I heard a lot of chatter and, you know, to my face also, you
what
know,
what kind of chatter?
Just that, you know, it's hard when the ballet world is so defined by uniformity, especially in the corps de ballet, which is, you know, the group of dancers that surround the leading dancers that kind of create the atmosphere and they want everyone to kind of blend in together. And I did not fit in terms of, you know, my skin color. So, you know, it wasn't until I really accepted, recognized, acknowledged that, and then owned it, that I understood the bigger impact that I could have on the world and on the ballet world. You know, it wasn't just about me being a ballet dancer, but it was like, this is a huge deal for our society, for the African-American community to be able to see someone who looks like them and feel that they can be a part of this world that they haven't always been accepted in. So I felt like I got to a point where every opportunity that I had to go out there and be on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House and represent brown dancers, it was like, this is for the little brown girls. I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this for the next generation. I'm doing this for those African-American dancers that were never given the opportunities that I have. And so I feel like that was kind of this fuel that got me to where I am today.
But when you joined the American Ballet Theater and there weren't other dancers who looked like you and there hadn't been someone who looked like you who had risen all the way to the top as a principal mm-hmm. dancer in an entire 75-year history, mm-hmm. did that affect how you saw your future, how you saw your own potential as you tried to launch your career?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't initially because, I mean, I had only trained for 4 years, and that's very rare before I became a professional. So
very rare.
I feel like, yeah, so I feel like I was so consumed with so many other things that it took me a couple of years before I kind of like lifted my head up and was like, oh my gosh, this is an issue, you know, that I'm the only one here. And it definitely, I think, hurt me the first, you know, maybe 5 years I was in the company. I had so much self-doubt and you know, I lost this very easy, natural confidence that I always had, you know, while I was on stage. And I think had I early on had more support and the support I try and give, you know, other dancers of color, maybe I would have had a quicker journey, or it just wouldn't have been so hard. And that's what I want for the next generation. I want this, you know, I think the discussion will always have to be had about the lack of diversity, but I want them to see a path and to be able to follow somewhat. You know, so many dancers throughout the history of ballet, they have a path set out for them, you know, and African-American dancers just haven't had that in classical ballet.
You know, It's super interesting to me that you brought up uniformity in the dance world. Your new book about sort of how to achieve this ballerina's body, the body is really like the thing that has to be uniform, and skin color can be a part of that, but a lot of other things can be a part of that too. I'm interested in what a ballerina's body means to you.
Yeah. So I think unless you read the book, it's hard to understand where I'm coming from in terms of choosing those words for the title. My acceptance and understanding of the ballet body has evolved so much throughout my professional career. And I think that the ballerina's body is constantly evolving from, you know, decade to decade. And, you know, you look back on, you know, dancers and Degas paintings and, you know, these dancers in the 1920s and 30s, and they had very feminine and soft bodies, and they weren't as muscular, and not at all as thin as people associate, you know, the ballerina body to be, which changed, you know, in the early 60s and throughout the 70s and 80s. Once again, it's evolved. We're much more athletic than they once were. So for me, I've learned that everyone's version of a ballerina body is going to be different. Like, we weren't all born with coming from the same parents. We don't all have the same genes and genetics. So we're going to look different, and we're going to have a different response to how our body builds muscle and, you know, how our muscles respond to doing the classical technique. So to me, having a ballerina body is having a strong and healthy version of your own ideal of what that means. So everyone's healthy body is going to look different.
When I was a younger kid, I was fairly serious about ballet, and there were auditions for the different, you know, big ballet schools and their summer programs, and they would come through town, and all the little girls would have numbers on the fronts of their bodies, and some of these schools would take photographs of you, like, from the neck down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the idea that, you know, that's part of the evaluation is just your faceless body and what kind of, like, quote unquote material this was. Yeah. And on the one hand, I do get it. Like, there is a certain body type that when it extends a leg to the fullest, it's going to look longer and more dramatic on one body type than another.
Right.
That kind of thing. I do get it, but I'm curious about your journey with all of that stuff.
Yeah. So I understand that that's just been how the ballet world has worked from the beginning. You know, that you have to have certain, you know, proportions in order for your lines and your body to read a certain way when you're on a grand stage. My belief is that you can shape your body to be whatever you want it to be. I think the knowledge that we have about cross training and eating right, Pilates and gyrotonics and floor bar, all of these things. There are so many extremely successful, well-known dancers that probably if you measured their proportions don't fit the mold of what you're supposed to be. Because when you go on stage and people are moved, it's that thing that you can't touch that a performer has that makes you drawn to them. It's not the length of their, you know, shin bone or the size of their head. It's that something special that performers, you know, special performers have that draw an audience. And to me, that's what we're trying to do. That's what we're doing as dancers and as artists. We're giving people an escape in the theater, and that has nothing to do for me with this cookie cutter body.
Is there a role that you have had that you think brought out that special touch from you in a particular way, like a role that you as a performer just connected with magically?
As a student, I feel like I connected with every role that I did and I felt just magical on stage. But as I got older, you know, again, I had so many obstacles that it took me a while to really own that again. And Firebird was probably the first of many that I really connected with. And I think it was just the timing of it all. It was the timing of, you know, being 29 years old when I was given the opportunity to learn and perform the part of Firebird, and just having this fire in me that, like, this is my last shot. Like, I'm old to be a soloist and given an opportunity to be a principal. And, you know, knowing of all the young brown dancers that were looking up to me, like, this is our shot, you know, gave me this added fuel.
No woman of color had played that role before.
Not an American Ballet Theater. The Dance Theater of Harlem, you know, their version of Firebird is actually really famous. And I have this image that's just kind of like embedded in my mind of being in New York City at 16 years old and seeing these Firebird posters of Dance Theater of Harlem with these black women doing the role. So in my eyes, it was like, yeah, the Firebird is a brown woman. That's like what I knew. But no, a black woman has not done most roles that I've done to this point as a principal dancer at American Ballet Theater.
The lead role in Firebird, it's very, for people who haven't seen it, the movements are, I would describe, just sort of jerky. Like, there's not the fluidity that people might associate with ballet.
Right. It's not at all Odette Odile in Swan Lake. She is a creature that has been captured. So every time you see her dancing, it's like she's trying frantically to get away. It's like holding a bird or a bat in your hands, and it's like the fluttering of their wings, like them trying to escape is I think the best way I can describe the movement of, you know, typically the choreography for the Firebird, which you know, is different depending on what version you're doing. I was doing choreography by Alexei Ratmansky, but you listen to the Stravinsky music and it's not fluid sounding, so I think you can imagine by listening to the music how the movement would be.
When was the last time you came back to Kansas City? I mean, you moved away at two, pretty young.
At two.
When did you come back?
So, gosh, it was the year that 9/11 happened in New York City. My birthday is September 10th, and American Ballet Theater came to Kansas City, and we were performing, and we arrived the evening of the 10th, and I saw family that I'd never met before, and I spent my birthday with them. And then the morning of the 11th, we woke up, and 9/11 had happened in New York City. And so that's kind of my last memory of Kansas City. It was something that I will never forget. And we still performed that night, even though, you know, I think that we just wanted to give people an opportunity to still have that escape and see something beautiful, even the evening of 9/11.
What were you performing that night?
There was a ballet called Black Tuesday.
Whoa.
And yeah, I know. So ironic, and interesting, but, it's a more, modern, I believe it's a Paul Taylor piece. It was difficult for a lot of the dancers, but it also was like a way of us just to like come together and, you know, unite in that way and kind of support each other and use the arts to bring people together, which is what it does.
When you met family you hadn't met before here, does Kansas City, I mean, it's been a while since, I guess that was 2001. It doesn't seem like Kansas City is a place you're racing to get back to, but.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that. I'm very excited. I just really haven't had an opportunity. You know, American Ballet Theater is a touring company, and I have quite a busy and full schedule, and we haven't been back to perform since 2001, so I haven't really had an opportunity, and I don't get a ton of breaks, so this is just kind of the perfect reason and excuse for me to be able to come down and with the new book, Ballerina Body, and it's really exciting.
Misty Copeland, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Misty is in town with her new book, Ballerina Body, Dancing and Eating Your Way to a Leaner, Stronger, More Graceful You. She's in Kansas City, but her events have sold out, so we hope you enjoyed listening to her on the radio. Our time is up, but you can listen back to this conversation and our discussion about rural journalism at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have the audio ready for you later today. Tomorrow, we'll meet the author of a new memoir called Headlights on the Prairie. Tune in for that discussion. And until then, keep in touch with us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tell us what you think of our discussions, what your input might be, and if you have an idea of something you'd like to hear us talk about. The show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.